Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Well, it's August, and we're on the downhill side of the year 2012. And you know what that means. Football season is just around the corner. We're a few months away from another presidential election. And in December, the world ends. At least according to Mayan calendars. Well, to celebrate the end of the world, I went out and got me a new pickup truck, maxed out all my credit cards on a spending spree that included a couple 56-inch high-def televisions, a 12-person jacuzzi tub, and four cases of the most expensive bourbon I could find. I also thought it might be worthwhile to talk about the end times with an old friend and previous guest on our podcast, Professor James Papandrea, an assistant professor of church history at the Garrett Evangelical Theological Seminary just off the campus of Northwestern University in Evanston, Illinois. He appeared on our podcast last summer talking about the early church fathers, but today I want to talk about his recent work on the book of Revelation in the New Testament, which was published under the title The Wedding of the Lamb, a historical approach to the Book of Revelation. Professor Papandrea's take on Revelation is an interesting one worth considering, in that rather than focusing on lots of end-time predictions, he places that last book of the Bible in historical perspective to understand the context of the author. Now, I want to remind folks that we're not a podcast that deals specifically with theology, although theological issues will obviously come into play here. I've invited Jim onto the show to give his take on the subject as a professor of church history. But it should also be noted that he is a scholar who is steeped in theological understanding of these texts. Jim has also written a lot of books on theology and spirituality and is also an accomplished musician whose songs are inspired by his own faith. So I guess you could say that Jim is a well-rounded religious guy. So we'll get a well-rounded perspective here. We will link to Jim's writings, his recordings, and a very fancy website on our website, so please peruse what he has to offer after you listen to our interview. Hey, Jim, welcome back to Research on Religion.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
So, for those of you who didn't hear our earlier podcast with Professor Papandrea, I should let you know that Jim and I knew each other in high school back in the late 70s and early 1980s, and it was around that time when a young R&B singer from Minneapolis named Prince was singing his hit song 1999 that was about the end of the world at the turn of the millennium. Well, we survived Y2K, and I'm still making my way through about a five-year stash of freeze-dried meatloaf that I've never quite eaten yet. But it looks like Prince was off by about 13 years, and 2012 is when everything is supposed to come to an end. So, Jim, I got to ask you, what are your big plans for December 2012?
Well, I guess my first item on the agenda is going to be to buy a new calendar for 2013.
Why?
You know, well, we have this idea, this sort of almost an urban myth that the Mayan calendar was supposed to end in 2012, and that implies an assumption that that would somehow be the end of the world.
Well, yeah, there was a whole movie with John Cusack called 2012. I mean, it was a documentary, as far as I understood.
Well, I can't say that I saw it, but I'm pretty sure it was fiction.
Oh.
You know, it would be a little bit like if archaeologists came into my office 10,000 years from now and found my calendar on my wall and flipped past December, and finding nothing after December, assumed that that would be the end of the world, rather than simply assuming it's time to buy a new calendar. And in reality, the Mayan calendar was simply meant to turn over, so that after 2012, the Mayans believed that the whole cycle would start over again. And in fact, archaeologists have since found more Mayan calendars that go beyond 2012.
You're kidding.
Nope.
Okay. So me rushing out and buying a brand new pickup truck and maxing out my credit cards might not have been a good idea, is what you're saying.
Well, probably not, although some people have tried to use the apocalypse as an escape from responsibility. That's really not what it's there for. I will say, though, that the Book of Revelation is a book of good news, not bad news, but not the way people think. It's not a book about escapism, and it's also not a book about revenge.
Okay, so it looks like I have a lot to learn through this interview here today, but before we start that, would you be interested in buying a 12-person jacuzzi or a zombie apocalypse survival kit? I have a couple left over here.
No, but I will take some of that meatloaf off your hands.
Okay, dehydrated meatloaf is always good. All right. So the Mayans got it all wrong. The world is not going to end this December. And if it does, who's going to say to come back and claim that we were wrong anyways? So actually, this is good news. You're right. The Seahawks actually have a chance to finally win a Super Bowl, which is good for me. But this Book of Revelation, which you speak, admittedly, for me, it has to be the spookiest book of the Bible with all the apocalyptic imagery, and there's a lot of people who spend time trying to figure out all the prophecies in this book and try to predict when the end of the world is coming. And it is, you know, in many ways a very mystical and spooky book. So what do you set out to do with your book, The Wedding of the Lamb, here with respect to the Book of Revelation?
Well, I have to agree with you that it is the spookiest book, at least in the New Testament, and that's what got me interested in it. I've been spending a good part of my life reading it, looking into it, and doing some research, and this book is sort of the result of my own research, and it is my own interpretation, my own take on it, based on my study of not only the history of the church, but the history of the Roman Empire, too. So, you know, unlike a lot of books, I am not trying to say that the Book of Revelation can predict the end of the world. It's not a code to figure out the future or the time of some future apocalypse. It is prophecy, but prophecy in the wider sense of the definition. Prophecy in general is simply when someone speaks a message on behalf of God to God's people. And that's what the Book of Revelation is. Sometimes prophecy includes promises and warnings about the future. Sometimes some of those are about later events that are to be revealed, and that's what the revelation is, things that are to be revealed. And some of those things are about what we might call the end of the world. But most of the Book of Revelation is really not about what we would call the end of the world.
That's kind of interesting, because the Book of Revelation is oftentimes associated with a lot of popular literature on the end times. The Left Behind series is a recent example that comes up. And, you know, even going back to our day, back in the 1970s, you had Hal Lindsey with the late, great Planet Earth. And I remember seeing videos of him with the nuclear explosions in the background, and points to one passage in the Bible and says, oh, this is what's happening here.
Yeah. In fact, I read all those books back then, and I was totally taken in by all that stuff. And you could have convinced me, you know, when we were in high school, that the aliens built the pyramids. But I moved on from that. And one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book was to give an alternative to some of what I consider less responsible interpretations of the Book of Revelation, especially some of the so-called end times fictional accounts that are out there that suppose that Christians are meant to take up arms and become an army and fight on behalf of God and fight God's enemies. And, you know, the truth is that the Book of Revelation is saying that God fights on our behalf, not the other way around.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's good. So let's go ahead and then let's dig into what you're talking about here, the history of the Book of Revelation. And I really appreciated that perspective that you brought here with your book, The Wedding of the Lamb. And it's a great read. And I'm going to recommend people stop by our website to find links to it and your website so that they can pick it up, because it's a really challenging read. It's very accessible, and it really puts everything into a context that you go back and you read the Book of Revelation, you go, oh, okay, yeah, I can understand that a little bit better. So let's go ahead and start with some of the basic questions that most people have, though, which is, first off, who wrote it and when was it written?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, there's a lot of debate over this, and I have my conclusion, and, you know, there are other scholars who would disagree with me. I want to say up front that one's conclusion about who wrote it doesn't really affect or change how I would interpret it, or, you know, the interpretation that I present in The Wedding of the Lamb. But I assume, along with the vast majority of early Christian writers, that the author of the book of Revelation was, in fact, John, the disciple of Jesus, the so-called beloved disciple. He was, according to tradition, he went to Ephesus after the life and ministry of Jesus. Ephesus is a coastal town in what we now consider Turkey. And he was eventually arrested and exiled for preaching the Christian faith, and was imprisoned on this island called Patmos off the coast of Turkey, and wrote the book of Revelation in about the year 95 A.D. or C.E. at the end of the first century.
Okay, so this is the John that we're talking about is the John who wrote the fourth gospel, right?
Yeah, presumably, although there's a lot of debate over who wrote the fourth gospel as well. But let's say for the sake of argument that it is the same John, and that would mean that probably the book of Revelation was written some 5 to 15 years after the fourth gospel.
Okay. And I know many people recognize the Gospel of John, too, as having a little bit of a mystical tone to it, at least compared to some of the three previous Gospels. And so can we figure out who wrote this by comparing the different texts of John to his other writings, perhaps, to the book of Revelation?
Well, you know, that's a difficult task, and scholars do attempt to answer questions of authorship by comparing one document to another. However, in this case, we have two completely different genres. We have the gospel, which is a sort of historical genre, although obviously with a theological agenda.
Mm-hmm.
And then we have the book of Revelation, which falls into the genre of apocalypse, things being revealed through mystical imagery. So it would be a little bit like trying to read my dissertation from my PhD program and then some work of fiction that I wrote and try to ask whether the same author wrote those two documents. It's just, you know, because they're two different genres, we can't expect them to be alike. And in fact, the book of Revelation claims to be the result of a mystical vision that John had while on the island. And I'm not ready to discount that. You know, some scholars would say that the whole visionary piece is a literary device, and maybe it is, but on the other hand, I'm willing to believe that John did have a vision, and that part of the reason that the book of Revelation is so difficult for us to understand is because he's trying to describe things that he saw in his vision that defy human language.
And so that would have a big effect on the literary style of what you're talking about as well.
Exactly, yeah.
Let me ask, so I want to probe this issue of John being the author here. One of the things that always got me thinking about this whole issue is when it was written in combination of who wrote it. So I'm thinking, you know, Jesus's crucifixion, a lot of people put it around 33 AD, and I'm thinking, okay, what age are the disciples that he has around him? And I say, let's err on the younger side. Let's say that John was 18 in the year 33. That makes him about 80 years old at the time that you're talking about the book of Revelation being written. I mean, 95 AD. I'm thinking, wow, you know, back that time in the Roman Empire, you know, that's really, really old. I mean, it's old for us today. We've seen increasing standards of living and increasing life expectancy, but is it possible that John got to 80 years old, or, you know, even potentially 85 years old, if you say, well, he was in his younger 20s when he was hanging around with Jesus? It just, could there be another person, John, or could John be that old?
Well, the answer to both of those questions is yes. And in fact, a lot of scholars will, in fact, rule out the disciple, John, as the author, simply on the basis of this span of time and how old he would have had to be. But what you have to remember is that while the average life expectancy in the ancient world was lower, that average is brought way down by things like high infant mortality rate, high rate of mortality in women due to complications in childbirth and other factors, and the very fact of slavery. And so all of these things bring the average life expectancy way down. But for a free male in the first century, it's not out of the question that he could live to be 80 or 90 years old, just like we do today. So it really doesn't, that in itself doesn't rule out John's authorship. Now, of course, there are people who would argue that, on the basis of other factors, that there may have been another John, whom they'll call John of Patmos, who may have written this document. And, you know, there's reasons to argue for that, too. But I come out on the side that John of Patmos is, in fact, the beloved disciple.
Okay. Let me just kind of ask this, and you don't cover this too much in the book, but what is some of the other evidence that people make the claim that, no, this wasn't the John of the Gospel of John, this, or the beloved disciple, this was some other John, you just got the address wrong?
Well, you know, one of the arguments is usually based on a difference of writing style, which we kind of talked about,
right,
or difference of content. I talk a little bit in my book on how the content between the fourth gospel and the book of Revelation is actually very consistent in terms of the theology of Christ as the Word and the Lamb and the developing understanding of God as a Trinity. And so, all of these things taken into consideration, would not convince me to abandon what the vast majority of early Christian writers believed, and that was that John the disciple wrote it.
Yeah, and you also mentioned, too, that there's that span of time between when the gospel is written in the 60s to the time when Revelation is written in the 90s. That's about 30 years or so. And I know that my own writing style has changed, even though you make a point that the content of what I write about is still pretty consistent. I still am pretty much thinking the way I did when I started writing academic stuff 20 years ago, but my style is so much different now that I think if somebody read something I wrote today as in compared to graduate school 25 years ago, they would say, must be a different person. But, you grow and you change and you deal with different audiences, I guess.
Absolutely, and in addition to that, the other thing that changes is the church itself. In other words, over the course of, a couple of decades, this early on in the life of the church is developing its own language to talk about its own life, and it's developing its own understanding of itself. And so new words are coming into use, new ways of talking about God and other things are coming into use. So the very sort of context of the content is evolving as well.
That's a really good point to make, because one of the most convincing and fascinating arguments of your book, and it tends to be the general theme of the book, is that Revelation was written for an audience that was experiencing this increased oppression underneath the Roman Empire. The church was changing. There was a very specific historical context. A lot of times the people who focus on the end time stuff see this as a book that was written irrespective of time, that it somehow time stopped and that this book was written. So let's dig into that. Fill us in on the history of the time there, what's going on in the Roman Empire, what's going on with the church, and what was it like to be a Christian in the Mediterranean circa the latter half of the first century?
Well, that's a great question, and I go into this in more detail in the book. The first thing you have to remember is that we sort of have to go back to the Emperor Nero in the middle of the first century. Right about the time that the Romans were catching wind of the very existence of Christianity as a movement separating itself from Judaism, there was a big fire in the city of Rome in the year 64. And the rumors were that Nero himself, the emperor, had ordered the fire to be started to clear land in the center of Rome for his new palace. Now, if you know Rome, this is the area where the Colosseum is now. Colosseum wasn't there yet. And so in order to deflect the blame from himself, he used this new sect, the Christians. They weren't even called Christians yet, but they became the scapegoats. And so this set a precedent of targeting Christians as somehow antisocial or even treasonous against the empire.
Oh, wait a minute, I got a question about the fire. Did Nero set this first as a controlled burn and it got out of control, or did he say, nah, let's just level everything and find somebody else to do blame for this?
Well, you know, we don't know for sure. Okay. No one knows for sure if he even said it, but if we assume that he did, and even the non-Christian Roman historians hint that people believed he started the fire, it probably would have been meant to burn down really only those parts of Rome that were considered kind of slummy, and the buildings were built of wood, and, you know, theoretically the fire wouldn't have spread to areas like the Forum where, you know, things were more built of stone, but, you know, who knows? It may have gotten out of hand.
Yeah, an early application of eminent domain seizures, I guess.
Okay. Yeah, exactly.
All right. Glad they're not doing things that way still today. So, okay, so go continue then. Fill us in. Nero, he's burning down Rome. He's blaming some Christians. What else is going on?
Right. Well, fast forward then to the year 81, and a new emperor comes to the throne. His name is Domitian. And Domitian is universally hailed as a new Nero, even among Roman writers. Everybody hated Nero so bad that when Domitian came on the scene and they realized they now had someone they hated even worse than Nero, they called Domitian the new Nero. And in fact, the book of Revelation alludes to that in, you know, the beast that is slain but then is revived. And so the first beast that is slain is Nero, who was assassinated, but then the spirit of Nero is revived in this emperor Domitian. And it was during his reign that the persecution was expanded, and it became dangerous to be a Christian even outside of Rome and in other parts of the empire. And it was in his reign that they started targeting church leaders and evangelists for arrest, torture, and possibly execution. And it's during that time that John would have been arrested and sent into exile on this island.
I can only imagine that this is going to play into how somebody writes, how somebody speaks, and how somebody acts. I mean, there are a number of brave Christians that would not, or I should say, went willingly to the lions, so they accepted martyrdom. But for a lot of people, you say, well, I kind of want to avoid the martyrdom for as long as I possibly can, or altogether. And so I'm going to kind of change the way I'm talking about stuff and make more allusions and when it comes to talking about things that are going on. Is that kind of what's happening?
There is a certain amount of that going on in the book of Revelation. I mean, I think that the language John uses in writing the book of Revelation is meant to do a couple of things. And one of the things it's meant to do is keep the language kind of for the insiders. So Christians will understand the imagery, but outsiders wouldn't. I mean, the other thing the language is doing is, as I said, trying to describe something that maybe defies human language. But when John wants to get his message across, he turns to the Old Testament for imagery because he knows that his Christians will understand the imagery, and, you know, if the book should fall into the Roman hands, they wouldn't understand it, which only highlights the fact that, you know, he wasn't trying to make it hard for them to understand. The book of Revelation is not written in code. It's just that it was written for someone other than us. So if we think it's hard to understand, it's only because we perhaps don't know our Old Testament well enough, or also because we're not living in that context of first century persecution.
That's a great point, because when you think about this now, when I look at the book of Revelation, there's a lot of mystical imagery in there. There's the almost kind of psychedelic aspect to it. You got shimmering seas of glass, you got creatures with glowing eyes all over their heads, and then this issue of symbols that you talk about. And we were just talking about Nero and Domitian, and how you had mentioned, well, you know, people saw Nero as a beast, and the beast was slain, and now he rises again. I mean, without that context, without knowing anything about Roman history, you know, all of a sudden this becomes some other kind of mystical beast for us, and you could see where a lot of other authors in contemporary times would be trying to figure out what that meant in our contemporary world and thinking about all these, you know, marks of the beast and the UPC codes on people's foreheads and things like that.
Yeah, right. And I mean, you know, a lot of people who try to interpret the Book of Revelation do it from the perspective of New Testament interpretation only,
yeah,
and don't take into account enough the historical context in the Roman Empire. And so you really need both. You need the historical context, but then you also need the biblical context. And so you need to be able to go to the Old Testament to understand a lot of the imagery. But the good news is that the images in the Book of Revelation, while they're borrowed from the Old Testament, they don't mean the same thing that they meant in the Old Testament.
Mm.
So you don't need to first figure out the Book of Daniel before you can read Revelation. What you need to do is understand, you know, the historical context within the persecution by the Roman Empire.
Yeah, now one of the things that your book does is goes through this imagery and puts it into the historical context, puts it into the Old Testament context, the biblical context, and says, okay, let's take a look at these things. So let's go ahead and do that and give our listeners a flavor or a sampling of what you're talking about here. One of the first things that you bring up, and this is also one of those things that captures the attentions of more apocalyptic thinkers in contemporary times, is the issue of numbers. And numbers are a big deal in the Book of Revelation, as they were in the Old Testament. And this is something that I actually don't pay much attention to, again, because I'm not in that context. And yeah, it's pretty easy to forget your Old Testament when you're reading the New Testament. So let's just go ahead and pluck a couple numbers out here and think about the importance of them. One of the things that I had never even considered until I read your book is this issue of fractions. Fractions come up in the book, and they are not just words that are thrown off, but they have significant meaning, things like one half or one third. What's going on with our fractions here?
Yeah, well, you know, first of all, what you have to remember is that numbers in the ancient world are symbols. And before the advent of Arabic numerals, which we use, numbers were just letters that were used to represent numbers. But in addition to that, the numbers themselves are also symbols. And so numbers have an almost magical quality because they can represent something as a symbol, but they can also spell words because the icons or the symbols, whatever that they're using for the numbers, are actually letters. Now, with the fractions, you know, you basically have to look at the denominator. And so if, you know, the denominator is one on the bottom, right?
We're not a podcast on algebra and math, but let's see, numerator's on top, common denominator, yes, denominator's on the bottom.
Okay, so you look at the denominator and you say one-third, okay, the denominator is 3. Now, 3 is a number that symbolizes perfection, right?
Mm-hmm.
But as a fraction, it symbolizes one-third is kind of a perfect portioning out. In other words, a God-ordained apportionment. And one-third is less than half, so it's kind of a minority, whereas two-thirds would be more than half, so it's a majority. So, you know, in the Book of Revelation, if one-third of a certain amount of people die, well, that's bad, but because it's one-third, it's less than half, so it means God has actually spared two-thirds of the people.
Yeah.
So, believe it or not, that's good news.
Yeah,
and it sort of works like that.
Okay. What about that number 3? You brought up, you know, talked about one-third, and then you mentioned 3 is a perfect number. Why is 3 a perfect number? What's the big deal about 3?
Well, you know, it's hard to answer the question why it is.
Okay.
It has been throughout most of human history, as far as I know, even outside of the Christian realm. If you think of, you know, if you can picture sort of an equilateral triangle, 3 is... has been a symbol of perfection. And, you know, I've got a new book coming out called Trinity 101, and in that I talk about the Trinity as, you know, as 3 being 3 in 1, and how there are just so many elements within creation that come in threes, and how our brain sort of seems to lock into threes, even to the point of, you know, like music that's in 3, it's in 3-4 time, is very sort of attractive to at least the Western mind. So, not sure I can tell you why, but I can tell you that historically 3 has apparently always represented perfection, and it certainly does in a biblical context.
Yeah, when I was reading that in your book, and you mentioned the 3/4 music time and how, you know, thirds become very important in music, I was thinking back to a podcast that we did with Justin Barrett on the innateness of religiosity, of just how we're born with a certain religious understanding. And he also used the music, as that we have this innate sense of music, too. Even, you know, it's not something that we're acculturated to. You can be acculturated to certain types of music, but, you know, little children who are clean, supposedly clean slates, really kind of like the music. And you bring up this issue of the quality. And as I was thinking about it, I love photography. And I was thinking, you know, I'm sending up a photo now to enter in a county fair. And they ask you for triptychs for 3 panels. And I said, well, I have 2 that would look really good together. And when I put the 2 together, I said, no, that doesn't look good. And if I added another photo to it, the triptych just looks so much better. For some reason or another, that 3 is a big deal, I guess.
Yeah, I think we are hardwired to be attracted to 3. And I can't explain it other than perhaps it is simply because we are made in the image of God, and God is a Trinity.
Yeah. That fits very well with Justin Barrett's podcast. And for those of you who are listening and haven't heard that one yet, we'll go ahead and link to it on our site. And it's one of the more fascinating ones that I've conducted. So please do check that one out. A few other numbers come up. And one other that is important or seems to give an impression of wholeness or perfection or completeness is the number 7. What's up with 7?
Right. 7 and 3 are actually very similar, but the way I look at it, 3 is more in the realm of perfection, where 7 is more in the realm of completion.
Mm-hmm.
The number 7 represents completedness, and so that's why in Genesis we get, creation in 7 days, because it's complete. It's perfect in the sense of complete.
And that brings up the infamous number 6. And this is when anybody talks about Revelation and you start hearing contemporary prophecies, the number 6 always comes up, especially when you combine it 3 times, the old 666 mark of the beast thing. And again, you get all these, you know, modern day imageries that, you know, people are going to have UPC codes stapled on their forehead and that. So what, I mean, 6 seems like a pretty nice number. Why does 6 get such a bad rap?
Well, you know, 6 is 1 short of 7. So 6 is the number of falling short of completion or perfection. And so 6 becomes, you know, the number of that which is imperfect or incomplete, and by extension, that which is evil or even sinful. Now, when you triple it, in other words, 3 sixes is sort of the perfect evil, right?
I see.
So 666 is the perfect evil. And in fact, as I said, you know, numbers were written using letters, and so that's why we have this this hint that the author of Revelation gives us, that the number 666 spells a man's name. He's not going to tell you the man's name because he doesn't want to get in trouble, but the man's name is the emperor, who was the emperor at the time. This is Domitian. And in fact, if you had a coin in your pocket back in the day, and you were reading, you were among the original audience of the book of Revelation, you could take that coin out of your pocket, you could look at the name of Domitian with his titles all abbreviated in Greek, and you could, turn those letters into numbers in your head and add them all up, and they would add up to 666. And so there have been a lot of speculation on what the 666 is and who it refers to, you know, everything from Nero to Hitler. I've even heard Ronald Reagan. But the reality is simply that it was not a code or a puzzle for the original audience of the book of Revelation. They would have gotten it immediately. It was their emperor.
Ah, okay. So somewhat undercover, but still somewhat everybody figured out what was going on with this kind of thing.
Sure.
Yeah.
Right.
You cover a lot of other numbers, and I don't want to spend too much time on this because I do want to direct people to your book, but some of the bigger numbers come into play, such as 144, and then another number, 1,000. And that 1,000 number is what gets all the millennialists up in arms because, oh, you know, 1,000 is important, so every 1,000 years You know, we're going to have a big, huge, mad rush to the zombie apocalypse survival store, and, you know, we saw in Y2K. What's up with these larger numbers?
Well, again, you know, they're symbols. And, you know, as I always tell my students, you know, numbers in the Bible almost always have a significance beyond their numerical value. The number 1,000 is simply meant to be a multitude or a lot of something. It's more than you'd want to count, you know. So 1,000 years is many, many years. Maybe you might think of it in terms of an eon or an epoch or something like that. But the point is that it's just, it's a lot of years. And so when we talk about the so-called millennium, which, by the way, is only like one verse in the whole book of Revelation, it's not meant to be taken as literally 1,000 years. It's meant to be taken as a long period of time. Now, the 144 is another issue. 144 is a multiple of 12. It's 12, 12. And 12 is the number that represents the people of Israel, the 12 tribes of Israel. And so that number gets sort of multiplied as, and then multiplied with 1,000 as well, and you end up with this number of 144,000 that gets interpreted a lot of different ways. But here, 1,000 is a multitude of people. 144 represents, 12,000 from each of the 12 tribes of Israel. And really all that number refers to is the sort of theoretical number of all descendants of the people of Israel who become Christian. So it's what we refer to as the Jewish church. In other words, Christians who are ethnically Jewish. And again, the number is not meant to be literal, as if you could count them. It just means this represents that part of the church that comes from Judaism. And we know that this is how the early Christians interpreted it, because we have mosaics in the churches in Rome that that show us this and talk about the Gentile church and the Jewish church coming together to form the one body of Christ. And so that's really all that means.
Hey, something just struck me as you were talking, and as we mentioned 144. 144 is what we also call a gross, is it not?
Right, yeah.
Yeah, a dozen. And I also thought, well, eggs come in dozen. You know, why do we get 12 eggs and not 10 eggs? And why is a gross 144? For me, I hear, oh, you got a gross. And I said, well, why is 144 important? It has this numerology or these numbers, these significant numbers in the Bible, work their way into the way we do our daily business of putting in eggs into baskets or, you know, calculating a gross? Do you know anything about that? Because it just all of a sudden, things are starting to click in my head.
Yeah, well, I can say that there are a lot of things from the scriptures, sayings and things like that, that do work their way into our daily lives. When we say things like the blind leading the blind, you know, these are sayings from the Bible.
Yeah.
As far as the number of eggs in a carton, I don't know. And if anyone out there can tell me why you can't get the number of hot dogs to match the number of buns in a package, that is something I would like to sort out as well. But
that is one of the great philosophical mysteries of all time, dating back to Machiavelli, Aristotle, and probably even before then.
I'm sure it is.
Yeah, that actually is a good question. Or why a baker's dozen is 13, which usually comes in donuts, which I never complain about. So,
right, an extra donut, that's a blessing in itself.
Absolutely, absolutely. So there you have that. I want to move on to other symbols. Now, we spent some time with the numbers, which often can be important, but there's a lot of other things that come up in the book of Revelation. This is some of the more vivid imagery that we oftentimes focus upon. And so let's go ahead and do that. One image that always comes up in the modern apocryphal accounts is the issue of the Antichrist. But you point out in your book, and I guess this is somewhat of a surprise to me, that the Antichrist is not mentioned at all in Revelation. So what is that all about? Where are we getting this Antichrist? Why is this important? And why are folks like Hal Lindsey all really focused on that?
Yeah, you know, it's very interesting, but the term Antichrist never appears in the book of Revelation. Now, it is in the New Testament in other places, and like, for example, in the letter of 1 John, the term is used to mean people who were adherents to a certain heresy in the early church. They denied the real humanity of Jesus Christ, and so by denying the humanity of Christ, they are called antichrists. They're against Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's sort of, you know, a way of talking about the early heretics. But, you know, there is, I think, one place where it says in the New Testament that there have been many antichrists who have come and gone, and more are coming, and maybe hints that there is one who is coming who is worse than the rest. But none of that comes up in the book of Revelation. And so I think what people try to do is they try to assume that the Antichrist or Antichrists spoken of in other places in the New Testament would be synonymous with the beast of Revelation. And if you want to make that case, I guess it's fair enough. I mean, you know, as I argue, the beast in the book of Revelation is really the emperors, the Roman imperial office, and specifically the emperors who persecute the church. And so... So that's really what's going on there.
Yeah, that's one of those head turners that you oftentimes hear, is that somebody comes up to you and says, hey, Antichrist is not mentioned in the book of Revelation at all. You go, come on, that's like the center point of it. And then you go back and you read through it and you go, oh yeah, didn't know that. It's kind of interesting how our biblical understandings can be morphed and changed by what a lot of people talk about when we don't spend enough time with our Bibles. And so, you know, maybe I got to get back to that, as my pastor tells me I'm a practicing Christian that needs a lot more practice. So,
aren't we all?
Yeah. One of the other things that comes up too in the book, and this relates to the title of your book, The Wedding of the Lamb, is this: there are several references to symbols such as the bride, the lamb, and weddings. And so two questions here. What is that all about? And why did you name your book The Wedding of the Lamb? What is central about that?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. I mean, as I argue in the book, I think that on one level, what John is doing in the book of Revelation is he's giving us a kind of expanded interpretation of Jesus' own preaching in the Gospels. And in a lot of the Gospel parables, Jesus uses this wedding imagery where, you know, heaven is described as a wedding reception, or he talks about the bridesmaids and the bride waiting for the groom. And what that reveals is that Jesus' understanding of the kingdom of heaven is that, you know, we live in a time sort of analogous to a time between the engagement and the wedding of a couple. And so if the church is the bride of Christ and Christ is the groom, we are engaged to our groom, but we have not yet come to the point of the wedding. Because what happens at the wedding? The bride goes to live with the groom, just as Jesus said, I go to prepare a place for you. And so we live in this in-between time between the engagement and the wedding. And what is going to be revealed, I mean, the title of the book of Revelation is something being revealed, and what is going to be revealed is that time when the bride and the groom come together, and that is the wedding of the Lamb. So that's why I called the book that, because that really is the whole point of the book of Revelation. It all leads up to that.
Yeah, and that is a wonderful understanding of this book, and one that I think gives a much more full interpretation than a person who, you know, when you talk about Revelation, you're talking about the four horsemen and apocalypse and all that. But yeah, the good news is woven throughout this entire book.
Yeah, and I mean, the other thing you have to remember, though, is that most of the book is covering events that, you know, are not really related to what we would call the end of the world.
Right.
In fact, the major portion of the book is about things that were already in the past when John wrote it. For example, the fall of Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And so all that stuff about the horsemen and stuff is really a sort of a theological description of what was happening in the sort of spiritual warfare going on behind the scenes when the Romans were oppressing the Jewish people, and when the Romans destroyed the city of Jerusalem and the temple. And this event was kind of like, it was kind of their 9/11, because it was something they never thought could happen, and it was something that caused for them a severe sort of loss of confidence and security. And so, you know, in addition to all the other things that are in the book of Revelation, John is dealing with those things in the past as well as making some promises and warnings for the future.
I want to come back about the time sequencing of the book, because you spend, or the book of Revelation, because you spend a great deal of time on that in your book. But I do want to finish up with a few other symbols here. The lamb, as we just talked about, the wedding of the lamb becomes very important. And, you know, that's a very comforting type of image, is that, oh, you know, God is going to have a place for us at the table. This is great that there's a fulfillment of a promise that is being made. And that's great. But on the other hand, there's descriptions in the book where you get a lamb with seven horns and seven eyes. That's a little creepy.
Well, again, you know, these images are not meant to be taken literally. And I've even seen some sort of, you know, animated representations of the Book of Revelation where, you know, artists will try to depict these things literally. And, you know, the Holy Spirit is, or there are other heavenly beings described as having wings and all of these eyes. And so, again, think symbolically. You know, horns represent power and authority. So you have evil powers with horns, and you have good powers with horns, or the lamb is Christ, and so he has authority, and his authority wins out. You have, you know, the symbol of eyes representing, you know, the ability to see. And so seven eyes is the, you know, if seven is the number of completion and fulfillment, so seven eyes means complete sight. It means omniscience, the ability to see and know everything. And so sometimes we get even attributes of divinity described in these very, you know, seemingly bizarre imagery.
Yeah. No, that is a good point to make, because when people try to depict these in paintings and you look at them, they become very surrealistic paintings, even more ancient ones before the, you know, period of art known as surrealism, and it can become really stunning. But again, you know, it's meant to convey certain types of symbols or different meanings to it, which is kind of neat. One other I want to ask about too, and our church covered this about a year ago when we worked our way through portions of the Book of Revelation, the issue of the lampstands. What are the lampstands all about?
Oh, I believe the lampstands represent the leadership of the church. In other words, thinking back to Jesus' sayings like, you are the light of the world, you know, don't put your light under a bushel, but put it up on a lampstand. And so the idea is that the leadership of the church, or perhaps the church itself, is meant to be a light to the world. And of course, all Christians are meant to be a light to the world. But there's a threat here that has to do with the lampstands, and that is that if they are not fulfilling their ministry, they can be removed or replaced. And I think that's sort of, you know, here we have John the bishop writing these letters to the churches under his authority and sort of pressing his own authority there over the leadership of the, you know, the local churches.
Yeah, and that's one of the things that we looked at in our series when we did this in our church. And if I'm correct in remembering this, and my pastor is going to remind me if I'm not, you know, five of the churches didn't do so hot. Two of them did pretty well. And these were basically messages to some of these churches that weren't doing so well to get their house in order, in essence, right? Because they are the lampstands and they got to shine light high.
Right, right. I mean, in reality, I think that, you know, there are seven letters in the Book of Revelation to these individual churches. And for the most part, in each case, John is saying, look, you're doing some things right, and here's where you fall short. But then, ultimately, the letters are letters of encouragement to keep the faith in the midst of the persecution. And really, I think that is one of the themes of the whole Book of Revelation, is to keep the faith.
Yeah, and again, with the lampstands, they have powerful imagery that stands outside of time. But as you mentioned, there, John is writing this to a certain people at a certain time to encourage them, to give them guidance. And that brings up the whole issue of the time sequencing. And the latter half of your book, you know, we won't have a time to cover this all, but you break the Book of Revelation down to various, I would say, eras of time, not so much as would be numbered on a calendar, but more general terms such as past, present, and future. And even when you talk about the future, there's two different chapters. There's John's future, which would be our past, and then the future of the future, which would be our future as well as John's future. So tell us what you we're trying to accomplish by breaking that down and what all this past, present, future, and future means.
Well, I think, you know, what I was trying to do was really sort of overcome the assumption that a lot of people bring to the Book of Revelation, that everything in the Book of Revelation is in our future.
Right.
That it's somehow a warning to us about how to predict our own future. When you look at it, there's a significant portion of the material in the Book of Revelation that refers to events that are already in the past when John is writing it, like, as I said, the fall of Jerusalem. But then there is the part that refers to his own historical context and the persecution and the place in the empire that the Christians find themselves in. And then when John goes into talking about warnings and promises for the future, he certainly does that, but we have to remember that there's over 1,900 years between him and us, and so, you know, one of the main things that John predicts in the future is the fall of the Roman Empire. Well, you know, why should we look for future persecution of the church and the future fall of a worldwide empire when this has already happened in our past and it's been fulfilled? And so when John predicts the fall of Rome, he was right. Rome fell, and the Western Empire had fallen within 400 years or so of the time of the writing of the Book of Revelation. Now, eventually, you do get to the point where you have to say, all right, well, what's left? What is left in the Book of Revelation that describes things that would still be in our future? And that's where you come to, you know, the true, what we call eschatology, the talk about the end times.
Well, let me hold you off just there, and I want to ask about fall of the Roman Empire, because, again, it's another great point that you make in this book, is that if we don't understand the historical context of this book, you're going to get people who are trying to predict the future, and they're selling books and videos about the fall of the empire. And I know so many people who peddle that kind of imagery are looking at the fall of the United States as being, you know, we're the next empire, we're going to fall. But as you point out, no, he was talking about the Roman Empire. Roman Empire fell. So, you know, there you go. That's what it is.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, I do admit that there are similarities between our culture today and the Roman Empire. And in fact, those similarities may be increasing as Christianity becomes less the dominant religion of the culture and more countercultural. But in essence, we don't need to look for a lot of these things to be sort of recapitulated in our future when they've already happened in the past.
Yeah.
And, you know, one of the things I do in the book is, at the end of the book, I have a section called The Book of Revelation in Plain English,
mm-hmm.
and I sort of recast the whole text of Revelation in a chronological order and, you know, taking the imagery and using more straightforward language, and so you can sort of see and read it as a narrative and see what, you know, I think it was meant to say.
Yeah. There's another good point that you make, too. When I teach my classes on political science and comparative politics, I usually take a very historical perspective on things. As you mentioned, oh, there's many similarities between us and the Roman Empire now, and I know a lot of people are on the news talking about this. Oh, we're on the next fall of the Roman Empire. But as I point out, you look at every civilization, there's various patterns that you can see repeated time and time again. And, you know, even though history never repeats itself, boy, there's a lot of familiar patterns that you tend to see over time. So,
yeah, that's very true.
Yeah. So go ahead and talk about the eschatology, because that is the future of the future, or not only John's future, but our future as well. What is this whole field of eschatology, and what is it talking about here in terms of the Book of Revelation?
Well, you know, the word eschatology comes from a Greek word meaning, you know, the culmination of things, the goal toward which all things are moving. And, I mean, a lot of people sort of assume that in the Book of Revelation, the concept of Armageddon is synonymous with the end of the world. But the concept of Armageddon in the Book of Revelation is not a physical battle here on earth. It's a spiritual battle that God fights, and that God fights on our behalf. And, it, you know, there is the promise in the Book of Revelation that one day evil will be completely defeated. And we don't know what that's going to look like, but it is going to, you know, encompass some kind of culmination of human history. At least this is what John and the early Christians believed, that human history was not cyclical, like some of the philosophers believed, just sort of, you know, recycling and starting over, but that human history was linear, and there would come a point when, you know, sort of the end of the world as we know it, to quote R.E.M. So,
right. Yeah.
You know, there would be a point when all things would sort of come to their culmination, but not in the sense of, you know, the sort of left behind idea that we have to, you know, put together an army and fight evil, but more in the sense that, you know, God fights that battle for us, and so it's not our place to take up arms or, you know, look for revenge against our oppressors or our enemies. It's our place to wait for the return of our groom and look forward to this reunion between Christ and his church. And so these are spiritual ideas, and they're not meant to be interpreted as, you know, literal warfare on this earth.
Yeah, I've always wondered about that. And when I hear a lot of these more apocalyptic eschatological versions of history and it's coming soon, and not only people are telling me about this, but they're asking me to buy my survival seeds and my dehydrated meatloaf and all that kind of stuff. And I sit and wonder and think about the spiritual guidance that God has throughout history. I say, you know what? I don't think dehydrated meatloaf is really going to be my main concern then, you know? So.
Right, right. Well, yeah, I agree.
Yeah. So it's one of those interesting things. And, you know, the fact that you talk about Armageddon as a spiritual battle, not just something here physically on Earth, is rather interesting. Let me just ask this kind of as a side note. Those folks that do peddle the I don't know, left behind imagery or the battle on Earth and be prepared for this kind of stuff, what are your thoughts on why they're doing this or what's going on there?
Well, I can't, you know, get inside their head and speculate on their motivation, but I think that there is a certain almost perverse looking forward to the end of the world as a kind of an escapism and a kind of way of focusing on something other than the world we live in. And in some circles, even within the church, the focus on the afterlife becomes an excuse to ignore poverty and injustice and other things we ought to be attending to in this life. So I think that there is a bit of an escapism in the sort of survivalist mentality.
Yeah. Let me finish up. We're just about out of time here. And you've spent a lot of your time looking at this. You've obviously written a whole book known as The Wedding of the Lamb, again, linked on our website for those of you who would like to take a look at it, and I do recommend that you do. You spent a lot of time with this, and as any scholar does, spending a lot of time with a specific topic, you see things you never saw before, you get new understandings, you find new controversies. I'd like to have my guest at the end of many of the podcasts that we have here kind of reflect upon what you learned or what they learned, and specifically to you, what you learned throughout this entire process. Is there anything that struck you as particularly important? Is there anything that you really changed your mind on as you went through this process of researching and writing the book?
Well, I mean, you know, over the course of my life, I've definitely changed my mind on what the book of Revelation is all about, because as I said at the beginning, I totally bought into the, you know, all of the Hal Lindsey stuff, you know, back in the day. But the other thing that I found that shouldn't have been surprising to me is that the book of Revelation is entirely consistent with the Gospels and with the message of Jesus in the Gospels. It is a book of good news. It's not the bad news, it's the good news. And the good news is that, you know, though we may face oppression, like, you know, the early Christians did, those who keep the faith, even those who follow Christ to the death, will also follow him in resurrection. And that's really the message. It's a message of hope, a message of encouragement to keep the faith, and ultimately it's good news.
And that is, I think, a great note to end off on here. I always like ending up with optimistic and encouraging notes, and I really did appreciate your book, The Wedding of the Lamb, and opening my eyes to the historical context of that book and how we can better understand it by keeping our history and the history of the church in mind. So, Jim, I want to thank you for once again being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.